Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring today's episode. Do you struggle on a day-to-day basis with staying happy and finding the drive to achieve your goals? As someone who has struggled for years with anxiety and depression, I understand how much of a fight it can be every day. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp assesses your personal needs and matches you with one of their licensed professional therapists. You can start communicating within 48 hours of registration, and it's not a crisis line or self-help. It's real, professional therapy done from the comfort of your own space. BetterHelp has a network of 20,000-plus therapists that are available to clients worldwide. You can log in and send a message to your therapist at any time and get timely and thoughtful responses. And you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions so you'll never have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room again. Because let's be real, therapy is intimidating enough. It should be as comfortable as possible. BetterHelp is also committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it's super easy to change therapists if you need to. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional therapy, especially since financial aid is available, because BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. To get started on a path to a happier life, visit betterhelp.com/unitherapy. That's better, H-E-L-P, and join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. There's also a special offer for UniTherapy listeners. If you guys use the link betterhelp.com/unitherapy to register, you'll get 10% off your first month. Again, that's better, HELP.com/unitherapy. Start healing your mental health today. Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to UniTherapy, the Happy People podcast. Or in more realistic terms, the mental health podcast for young adults, where we talk about everything mental health related, and we have the conversations that no one wants to have because they're uncomfortable. So welcome to the community. I'm so glad you're here, and let's hop right in. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to UniTherapy. If you are new here, my name is Emily, and I am here to hold your hand while we walk through all the craziness of the mental health ups and downs. If you are not new here, thank you so much for continuing to come back and listen to the podcast and just be a part of this amazing family that I adore with my whole heart. I apologize for being gone for 2 weeks. Life just got kind of really crazy. I was gone. I was traveling. I was on a little vacation, and then I was on set for a project, and I just ran out of time. Also, this episode is a day late than I usually upload, and that's just because I didn't get my shit together yesterday to edit and upload, so I apologize for that. But we're getting our shit together today, and we're here, and we are all about it. So, we have a new episode today, and I am so excited about this episode. We have another guest on. So if you are new here, I usually start off the episodes with what I like to call my life breakdown, and that's where I just share, you know, the highs and the lows of the week or since we last chatted. Just kind of loop you guys in on what's been going on. But on days where I have guests on, I don't do that because I just like to hop right into the episode and the interview with whoever we have on. And we have another guest today. I was so lucky to get to chat to the lovely Molly Ray, who you will be hearing from in just a second. They are a relationship coach, and they work very closely with queer, trans, and non-monogamous people. And oh my goodness, I just adored talking to Molly so much. Just an absolute beam of light and positivity and just amazingness. I love their energy so much. I really am so excited to have you guys hear what they had to say. I learned so much. Molly, thank you so much for coming on and just teaching me things that I have never even thought about, you know, being things or anything. So I really, really, really appreciate it. I'm so excited for you guys to hear this episode. So let's just get on into it.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can.
So nice to meet you, Emily.
Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Face to face.
Yeah, virtually meet. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day and coming on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm so excited. Honestly, this is my first podcast, and I'm like just very excited to be entering into the world of podcasts.
I'm so excited to be your first podcast.
Yeah.
All right. I love your lip color. It's
thank
so
you.
Fun. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, I was like, I'm going to dress up today, or, you know, I do so much, like, all of my work from home, so some days it's, like, jammies and nothing, which is fine.
I'm the exact way.
Right? I'm like, I'm wearing pants and a shirt. And
I know, I put on a skirt today, I was like,
look at us go. Starting this Monday off right.
Oh, yes. So, first of all, I noticed that you use both she and they pronouns. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask if you had a preference for when I introduced you and everything.
I think a mix of the two works well. Yeah, okay. I like the they is like a relatively newer pronoun. I would say in the past year I've started using they, and I will also say that, like, I'm not offended. I understand that, like, if we default to she, I understand that, and I am okay with that. But I think a mix of both is always great.
Okay.
And I'll introduce myself and I'll, you know, state my pronouns. And I had one question about one of the questions, which I was like, I should have emailed you about.
Is it number 4?
Yes.
Okay. So this is so embarrassing. So I was working on like the first part of these questions at like 2 a.m. when I was exhausted.
Oh my gosh.
And then I went back this afternoon. I was like, I'm going to double check and like print them out. And I was like, I read it all through them. And I was like, wow. I was like, that didn't even make sense. So I fixed it.
Cool.
So I fixed it. So I will ask it correctly. But
I assumed it's like, why do therapists pathologize?
Yeah. Yep. I was just writing with my eyes half open.
That's how I answered it. Like, I wrote a bunch of notes and I have them. I don't know if I'll look at them, but like, I was just organizing my thoughts and I was like, pretty sure that's what that means. And like, you know, we all go through our stuff. So yeah.
I was just writing with my eyes half open, you know, and
I get it. And I could pick up what you were putting down and no harm to foul.
Yeah, no, I went back and I was like, that's so embarrassing, but I fixed it. I did fix it.
Hey, yeah, we all make mistakes. Also, like, whatever. I'm smart enough to know, like,
I figured
I know what this means.
I figured you were going to pick it up.
Okay, great.
Yeah, so that's fixed. That's all good.
Cool.
Alrighty. So we already are recording on my setup over here, so I think we're just going to go ahead and get into it. Starting off, if you just want to introduce yourself, who you are, and what you do.
Yeah, so I'm Molly Ray. That's my name. My pronouns are she, they. Just to start off with some kind of identity pieces about who I am, I am white, I am a queer femme, non-binary, very much still figuring out, like, who I am. And by figuring out, I just mean, like, that's a fluid process, and words sometimes fit, and labels sometimes fit, and sometimes they don't, and I'm, like, okay with that. I just know that non-binary, in some sense of, like, the idea of this binary gender doesn't totally fit well with me. And I love, like, feminist and queer feminist. I am polyamorous, and I think we'll get into a lot of that and how that's kind of like my personal and professional identity and the work I do. I'm a relationship coach and a counselor. I have a relationship coaching business and an Instagram account called Bonobo Relationships. And it's specifically, like, I would say my quote-unquote niche is, like, working with non-monogamous folks. And I say non-monogamous instead of polyamorous because I feel like non-monogamy is a really broad umbrella term for many different kinds of doing relationships. Polyamory is one of those. And so just to kind of make the distinction, I might toggle between the two because polyamory is also a very kind of accepted term and people know what it means. But I do usually tend to say non-monogamous for that reason. I also kind of have a lens of like kind of centering queer and trans folks and stories and narratives, because, I have, you know, affinity and personal experience and as with those, like as a queer non-binary person and also working with queer and trans folks. And I just always want to center that. And then I also do counseling on the side with another, company. I just got my master's in social work in May, just graduated.
Oh my gosh, ooh, congratulations.
That was thanks. Oh, it was a long haul. And I will be like working towards licensure through that as well. So right now I'm providing counseling, or it's called like lay counseling, which is a really cool thing. We probably won't get into it, but I also like will be using, you know, getting that experience and having supervision and getting my LCSW. So, I do coaching and also counseling. They're very different. And there are very kind of ethical things different with them. And, I love doing it. I love the focus on working with non-monogamous folks, and I love counseling with just like anxiety, depression, and just like kind of regular old human things. But I really love providing kind of that one-on-one work that is like my heart, happy, joyful, passionate place.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love people that like just love to help other people. That's always the best. Perfect. So what initially sparked that interest in that line of work?
So I have always been just like focused on relationships. I mean, and I would say like specifically like romantic sexual relationships. I was the preschooler who was like running around kissing boys. I'm not going to talk about the consensuality or lack thereof of that. I was a non-consensual 3-year-old, fight me, or you know, like, yeah, that happened. And I have learned a lot more about consent, and I, you know, have my own journey around that. But yeah, like I've always just been, I've loved relationships. That's always been a passion of mine. That's always what I'm focusing on, right? Like I did all kinds of things, but I the forefront of my mind is always often my like most deepest intimate relationships, whether it's friends or lovers. I think you could ask like, and often there's like almost even some, like there's just like depth and like intensity to it. Like I'm a theater kid. I think I'm, you know, I'm dramatic.
Me too.
You can probably ask any of my friends who've known me for like 20 plus years. And they'd be like, oh yeah, you're just like, that's you. You've always been that way, you know? And it's always this focus around relationships. And when I think about like even my professional work, and I say like work, right, paid work, it's like I've been a barista, I've been an office manager, I worked in nonprofits specifically one nonprofit for 7 years, and what I got the most joy out of in all of those jobs was the relationships, right? Like as a barista, like I just love the, like, you have regulars who come in and you have your little banter and you're like, you know, here's your 3-pump vanilla latte or whatever. And you're just like, you're like, oh, tell me about your dog. I don't know. I just like, I love the relational aspect of the work I do. And in the nonprofit work, you know, we were doing a lot of community work, and I was a manager, which was really hard and I totally burnt out. And like the best part of that was the relationships that I built both with like the people I was managing and the staff, and just like, I mean, I was there for 7 years. So all of just my coworkers, and of course the people we worked with in the community. I believe that relationships, and then, also as like my kind of political awareness grew, and I would say that like that probably started in my late teens. I even like, I think that everything is relational, right? Like if we look at like the way that systems impact us, right? Like that's a lot of like the relationships we have to those systems or how they impose upon us and how those impact our personal relationships. I have a passion for macro level, or I have an understanding that's so necessary to do like to look at the structures and systems and change them. And I also know like, that's not my work. Like that doesn't bring me joy. And I know it's so necessary. And I like a lot of people in my community and networks do that work. And I used to be like, oh, am I bad? Like that doesn't bring me joy. And I'm like, no, that's just like not my work. But I think drawing the parallels between like how those systems impact us and impact our relations, right? Like when we look at like big structures or parts of socialization, right? Like patriarchy and white supremacy and all of these things, like those impact us and those impact how we're able to relate to each other. And so like, I like to look at kind of that, intimate level of like, how is this, you know, our relationship to ourselves, our relationship to others, our caregivers and parents and, you know, all of that, really taking into account like the bigger systems and how they impact us. Mm-hmm. And then I would just like, in terms of non-monogamy and I think queerness as well, like there's just this challenging of norms, right? I mean, I remember I was probably 20 or 21. I don't even remember exactly when, but it was around that, like, you know, a lot of us even today, like we don't know that polyamory or non-monogamy is even a possibility. You're just like, mm-hmm. or I'm in these relationships and I like have crushes on other people, or like, I'm kind of slutty. And like, there's all kinds of slut shamey things about that. Right. But like, and then when I like, you know, had a roommate who was non-monogamous and trying it, and like, you know, I think gave me the ethical slut, I was like, oh my God, this is a thing. Like, this is me. Like, it was this huge relief and sense of like, wow, this is so cool. And I say that like I've been theoretically non-monogamous for like, you know, what is it, almost 15 years now, 12, 13, however many years. But like, even through that, like there was just a lot of deprogramming around monogamy culture, and like I'm a people pleaser, so there's all kinds of things in that that like I wasn't fully, I would say, until like 3 or 4 years ago, able to really be like, no, like this is who I am, and like this is like, I will not be in monogamous relationships again, because it doesn't fulfill me, and it's not, you know, not good for me or the people I date. And so I studied like non-monogamy and you know, read the books, or many of the books, and been theoretically like just like, oh yeah, non-monogamy is great. I do feel like in the past few years I have kind of like become kind of a, not expert, I don't like that word, I don't really know what that means. But I do feel like I understand the basic like relationship, like the tenets of relationships, which honestly I think the basic tenets of non-monogamy can be like could be and should be present in many relationships. I think that I just love that it challenges norms, again, as does queerness. There's so much. And I think it just really speaks to my ethics and values as well, about like how to be in like connected, intimate, loving, kind relationships.
I love that. And I love that you brought up how, you know, like higher social structure and like all that is like kind of comes full circle with our relationships and how that's all connected. And I love that. And I also love, oh my God, I love when you were talking about like kind of having to retrain your brain on what was like, okay. Cause like, I get that too, because I, in the past few years, have come out as bisexual, but I was like, mm-hmm. raised super Catholic. So there was like, mm-hmm. a whole lot of like, it's okay, you're not like gonna go to hell, you're fine.
Oh my God. So like,
you
yeah.
know, so like I love, because like I feel like that's a big part when you, you know, are, you know, come out as anything than what's deemed normal, like socially, totally. Politically, religiously, like there's a lot of guilt and shame that you have to overcome.
That's so true. And it's, I think we just like live in a culture that's really shamey. Like it's just like, yeah. And I think it's about control. And I mean, it's about power and control. And I think shame is a really big piece of that. And it like, we all kind of, obviously I'm talking in hyperbole, but like we all kind of gaslight ourselves all the time. I'm like, am I allowed to do this? Right. Like there's no, I haven't seen this in media. Like I haven't seen that. Like I have no like context. So I kind of always feel like, is this okay? Like, is this feeling, you know? Right. And I think there are also like certain personality types that might be a little more like, again, I have that people pleaser and like certain parts of myself that are, just question myself a lot. And so, it really is a lot of deprogramming. I will say like, even though this has been something that I study and, you know, love to learn about and work with people on daily, like I still in my own relationships, like struggle just because relationships are hard and they bring up all your stuff. And so like, it's just, I just want to normalize that like relationships are hard and they take work. And even if you have a lot of skills and tools and knowledge, like still, you're just triggered all the time, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God. Cause like, it's like, no matter how much therapy you go to and how many tools you get in your toolbox, like your trauma and your like the way your brain works, it doesn't go away.
Yeah, totally. Yes. And it, you know, it's a journey. It's you know, and I'm sure your listeners know that it is a journey. One step back, you're, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And our stuff will always be our stuff. It's just kind of learning how to like honor it and move forward and deal with it or work with it, you know, with curiosity and compassion for ourselves. And I think that will also translate to others to like how we treat others. But anyway, I feel like that's for later.
I love the curiosity and compassion for ourselves. That's so, I love that. What a positive way of thinking. Okay. So moving on so obviously you have that passion for non-monogamous relationships. Is there any way you can give us like a brief history about those relationships, kind of how they've evolved over the years, kind of stuff? This is like genuinely just my own curiosity because I don't know anything about really any of that. So
this is a really interesting question because I think to talk about the history of non-monogamy, which I will say I'm like by no means an expert on. I don't even know if there exists like the history of non-monogamy, but I have some research to do there. But I think it's actually really interesting to look at like the history of monogamy and the history of like marriage and starting there, I think is really important because, there's some theories, and I'm going to speak to one which was like kind of put forth in this book, Sex at Dawn by, Christopher Ryan. And I think, Kasilda Jatha is how you pronounce her name. I've read it for 10 years because this book came out in like 2010. And their hypothesis, which has both been like, there's a lot of debate around it, but I think there are definitely tenets to it that at least speak to me and like I think can help us at least critically think. And it's that like, so you know, it kind of looks at this evolutionary biology of like how humans used to be, right? Which we don't really know. How humans used to be was like these hunter-gatherer communities where, you know, there wasn't necessarily like partners in the sense of like monogamous partners. Actually, like the name bonobo, do you know about bonobos? I feel like I'm going to go on the tangent here. Okay. Let me do a quick bonobo tangent, which is not really related, but like kind of is. So bonobos are our, similar to chimpanzees are our closest evolutionary relative. Okay. So we have chimpanzees and bonobos, and a lot of people don't know about bonobos. And there's kind of this like very simplified version that like, there's like the peace and love species, which are bonobos, and the like war angry species, which are chimps, which like, again, very simplified because they're complex creatures. But bonobos are, you know, society of apes who are, they live in matriarchal societies. So the women, you know, kind of quote unquote run things. They solve everything or like, if there's any kind of discomfort, like they have sex about it. Like, and everyone, like males, females, males, right? Like everyone, there's not really like gendered, you know, sex. So they like, you know, if there's like some kind of conflict around food, right? They'll just kind of like do a little like you know, touch their genitals together and figure it out. And I don't know the details of that. And you know, another thing about it is like they evolved in a really like food rich area. So like there wasn't a lot of resource scarcity. And so there's a lot of theory that like, because they didn't have this resource scarcity in kind of the way that chimps did, like they were able to have this more empathetic and like altruistic society. If another bonobo from another bonobo group comes in, like they will accept it and like kind of bring it into the fold. And then we have chimps on the other hand who like are really violent and like they would like the men will like circle the perimeter of their territory and like kill anyone who any other chimp who's like, and there's like infanticide. It's like they're like really violent. Yeah, right. Like, sorry to go really dark here, no, but like chimps are, yeah. And so, you know, there you can get really like anthropomorphizing of bonobos and chimps, which like I do tongue in cheek because I realize like we're very different. We're humans. Like I'm not really trying to make any broad sweeping statements, but I really like the symbolism of like bonobos. Yeah. And that idea that like, you know, obviously like consent is very important to me. So I'm not like, we should all just be having sex with each other all the time. Because that can get problematic. But like a general, like, I think there's like a symbology of like sex positivity, right? And like and that sex positivity in the broadest sense of the word. And anyway, back to the history of monogamy. so there was this theory that like we used to be more kind of like bonobos, essentially. Okay. And then with the advent of agriculture, which was about 10,000 years ago, we started having like humans being, of course, more place-based, right? Like tied to a place. And then we get kind of like power dynamics, women kind of seen as property, and like marriage kind of becoming this like very economic, you know, like something that was like, how can we merge these families to have like, you know, have our, be able to hoard power, right? And we see like marriage has kind of become a, yeah, like just an economic tie. And of course, like throughout the years, there's been a lot about love and now like monogamy as a whole, I would say the monogamous industrial complex kind of, but like there's I think a lot of it has to do with this, like kind of like, there's a lot of vestiges of this idea that like you own your partner. And I know that sounds really again dramatic, but like, I think like, if we think about it, there's this like, oh, like we are in a monogamous relationship. So like, you know, that means that we can't, like there's kind of a big limitation to one's autonomy. And I also want to just name, I know so it could seem like, I think like, oh, everyone should just be non-monogamous. I don't believe that. I don't believe non-monogamy is necessarily like, I don't know, quote unquote, more evolved. Like I don't have an agenda to make people non-monogamous. I think there's a lot of reasons people don't choose monogamy. I do think there's this like compulsory monogamy that like people are, it's the cultural norm and it's like what you do, so you don't think about it. And I would like to just get people starting to think like, why am I choosing monogamy, right? Mm-hmm. And that's great if you're like, you know what, non-monogamy seems like a really big hassle, like it seems complicated. It is, it's not a hassle, I would say, but like it is, the more dynamics you have. But I just want to name that I'm not like on a soapbox of like everyone needs to be non-monogamous, because I think like I fully believe that like people should do what they want. But I do think like questioning why we do things is really important to kind of like self-actualization and being in more intentional relationships, right? Like if you can choose, like if you're with a partner or if you're, you know, dating and you're like, actually like why, like have really good reasons for choosing monogamy or non-monogamy. Like, I think that's really important to just like say like, I'm intentionally doing this and here are my reasons why, as opposed to like, this is just what society tells me to do. Right. I think that just helps us be more critical thinkers in the world and have deeper and more connected and more fulfilling relationships.
You're good.
Yeah. So then, I mean, you asked about the history of non-monogamy and I'm like, I mean, that's so there's like, also sometimes people say consensual non-monogamy or ethical non-monogamy. I like to say just non-monogamy because I feel like adding that qualifier is kind of like saying non-consensual sex, which is just kind of like rape, you know? Like, I think, right. like it there's either non-monogamy or cheating, right? And cheating is not ethical, and like those are two very different things. And you can cheat in non-monogamy, right? Like mm-hmm. like it's possible to do that. It's all about like the agreements that you have with your partners and how you're, you know, living those. But back to like non-monogamy, I mean, people have been cheating forever, right? So like I think that begs the question, like, are we monogamous? Because like if we were like quote unquote naturally monogamous, then like why would there be all these statistics of cheating, right? I think something like, I heard a statistic which is really broad, like 40-80% of people have cheated in relationships, right? Like that's a very large range, but still, like, you know, and we know like divorce rates are 50%, right? Like so I think there's you know, just a lot to beg the question of like, are we monogamous? And honestly, like, I know it's important in some sense of like understanding evolutionary biology and things like that. I'm just like, hey, if people like do you, boo, right? Like, like if you are monogamous, great. If you're not, great. If you're choosing it as a lifestyle, it feels more like an identity. Like either way is great. Mm-hmm. And you know, why would we yuck your yum? And so, yeah, so within non-monogamy, so people have been doing non-monogamy, even if it's unethical, for a long time. I would say like in the 60s and 70s, as like the free love movement kind of became a big thing, we saw like some communities pop up. There's like the Carista Commune, which was in San Francisco, which is like a non-monogamous and kind of like utopian society. And, like you just saw kind of, again, like in the kind of cultural revolution, not cultural revolution, but the that like moment in the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. That was really questioning a lot of things. I think one of those things was monogamy. Mm-hmm. And then in the, you know, I would say like throughout then, it's just been like, I think the 90s had a lot of like, a lot of folks who had been like practicing for many years were kind of coming out and writing books like The Ethical Slut, opening up, but that was a little later, but I think the like first forms of non-monogamy were kind of like very, and there's always outliers, but like couples who were already a couple then exploring, right? So it was this very like hierarchical non-monogamy that was kind of like the I would say like status quo. I do also think like queer people have been doing non-monogamy. I know like in the gay male community that's been a kind of cultural thing that in that community, and I think queer folks often just like are challenging things more. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I think like there was a lot of like kind of dyad meaning like two people, like a couple, kind of like there was swinging was very popular, still is a thing, you know, where couples would like maybe switch partners or go to play parties. And then there was like this, you know, kind of like this distinction between hierarchical versus non-hierarchical partnerships, which is like a hierarchical one is where there's like, I have a primary partner and like, that's my maybe nesting partner or life partner. And then I have, you know, my secondaries, which was words that were kind of used, still kind of are, but there's been more critique of that. And so there's just been an evolution. And I think now we are seeing a lot more like what are called solo poly people, solo polyamorous people who like their first partner is themselves, you know, like their primary partner is themselves. And there's relationship anarchists who are like, all my relationships have the potential to be equally balanced, like friendships and lovers and family or whatever. So I think there's just, as we get into the depths of non-monogamy, like there's just more kind of like critiquing and exploring, like, how do we make relationships that how does each person kind of create the relationships and each group of people create the relationships that most satisfy them?
Right.
Yeah. That was a lot.
I know, but I learned, this is a topic I have no clue on. Yeah. Like this is a point of view that totally. I have at all. So I love learning. And like the reason I asked more about the history of it, because like, I think the only real, like, I guess, example of like a non-monogamous relationship that I've ever seen growing up was religious, was like through like Mormons. So like, you know, that's really, because like my mom was for a while raised Mormon because of, like, somebody that married into the whole family. And there's, like, she's part of the, I don't know if you know who Warren Jeffs is, but, like, he's the whole big. Yeah, so,
I
like.
I just watched that whole.
So that documentary has, like, part of my mom's family. Because, oh, like, her brother or her, like, her uncle's sister or whatever, like, married into that or whatever. So, like, that was, so that's, like, when she got, and, like, she was almost married, like, off at 16 to, like, one of her cousins. Wow. And, like, yeah, so that's the crazy, like, that's really the only, image of, of non-monogamy that I've ever seen. So I was kind of asked, is, like, the difference between that and, like, I think non-monogamous relationships now.
Yeah. There's, I mean, I think, like, when we think about stereotypes of non-monogamy, we think, like, isn't that what the Mormons do? And right. It's like, I mean, yeah, but again, that's the consensual piece, is, like, right. Is that non-monogamy or is that, like, forced religious trauma? Like, right. Like, forced religious abuse, you know? Like, right. Like, that gets, you know, I think that that's a distinction, which I, right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot. Thanks for sharing.
Oh yeah, no, we talked about that. She was like, the documentary came out, and she was like, I think there's some of my family in this. And it's like, oh no. But yeah, but I feel like in that too, that was more like of a property thing too. Totally. So, you know.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, like, the core, I would say, values, or at least like the principles that many people are drawn to in non-monogamy, is like, it promotes really strong communication, right? Which is hard for a lot of people, like, and honesty, and like, it will grow you because it kind of brings up all your shit in a different way than like monogamy. Like, it's easy, I think, easier in monogamy, like, again, relationships will bring your stuff up, but like, it's in polyamory, like, it will bring up all of your attachment wounds because, like, right. Someone, like, is you are, you know, consenting to letting someone be with someone else. And if you have, like, abandonment wounds or, like, other, you know, like, or if you have more avoidant tendencies and it's easier, you know, like, you don't want to talk about things, like, that will really hinder the relationship in a way that's, like, very critical to a non-monogamous relationship's, thriving or right. surviving even. And again, like, that is also true in monogamous relationships. It's just, it's a little different because, like, you have to be talking about things right, to do it well. You know, there's like different ways to do it. There's one called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which gets a lot of flack, I would say, in like the world of non-monogamy. Cause it's like, it's again, people are consenting to say, like, hey, I don't want to know what you're doing. Like, do it because I support that, but, like, I don't want to know any details. Right. And again, like, there's feelings in the community about it. I'm of the opinion, like, hey, if you are consenting to this and you understand the reasons why you're doing it, or, you know, like, or maybe it's a stepping stone to being able to, you know, acclimate to it better, like, it doesn't have to be terribly toxic. I have done it before. I hated it. It, like, I'm not gonna do that, but, like, I could understand why someone might, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's all kinds of other different, like, ways to do non-monogamy.
Right. Well, like, it sounds like it's gonna kind of be like a forever, constantly changing, growing kind of, you know, dynamic, because it's I think, like you were saying, there's constantly, you know, things are, you know, being discovered, and there's more coming up, and, like, everyone's learning and growing.
Yeah. And I mean, again, like, ideally, that's how we all operate in life, right? Like, in any of our relationships, right? Like, we change throughout our lives, right? We meet, let's say you meet and marry someone at 25, like, the changes from 25 to 35 I'm generalizing, but, like, are a lot, right? Or, you know, even, like, just, you change throughout life, and your desires and just, like, your personhood changes. And, like, I think that is what non-monogamy really brings to the surface, and, like, accepts that change and accepts, like, that, like, hey, people are going to change, and that's okay. And we can, like, acknowledge and address those as they come up. And, like, we really, like, it really prioritizes autonomy in a way that I think is really helpful. I do have, like, some critiques of that. And, like, I think there's also, like, we need to be kind and tender and like not just focus on autonomy, but like I think it's really great to like, you know, have a loved one, a lover, anyone, and be like, hey, like I really want you to be fulfilled, and if in this relationship like I can't give that to you, like that might be hard, but like I don't want to keep you in a relationship that you are not feeling however you want to feel in, right? And that's like a really, like that brings up your ego shit, like that like is really hard to be like, wow, like to be like kind of opening yourself up to potential hurt, like in a very intentional way, like whew, that is hard.
Yeah.
And really beautiful. And again, not for everybody, and that's okay.
I'm learning so much. I love this conversation today. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
All right, moving on to number 4, which I did fix, so we're all good now. But so you were talking about that there is a lot of therapists that pathologize non-monogamous relationships, and that just like don't understand, and that was where a lot of your passion came in. So why is that really?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, therapists are people too, right? And they grow up and get socialized in the same way that the rest of us do. Right. And I think like it's really easy for a relationship therapist or a therapist, you know, to who doesn't understand non-monogamy to have a couple come in and say, hey, we're struggling with this, and be like, well, obviously like that's your issue. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's not great to do. Cause it, again, like you don't want to pathologize this. Right. But it's just like, they don't have any context. Mm-hmm. I just did my MSW, and there was a one unit like elective course, which I don't think a lot of people took. And that was the only time that non-monogamy was ever talked about in my program. Right. And so like, and social work doesn't totally get into like relationships in the way that maybe an MFT program would, but I've talked to folks in those programs as well, who were like, yeah, we don't talk about non-monogamous relationships, but there's no education on it. Maybe that's changing. I'm hoping that's changing, but like, you don't know what you don't know. And like, there's just, again, there's not a lot of, there hasn't been historically a lot of just like cultural understanding, and like monogamy is so the norm that like anything outside of that is like just not understood. Probably there's a little like fear around it. I think, it can bring up just like in terms of like transference, you know, like, oh my gosh, like this is kind of feels like an affront to like, I mean, a good therapist obviously like tries to keep that at bay and challenge their biases. But like, again, like, it's easy to like pathologize the thing that you don't understand. Right. Also just like therapy, like I would say the field of therapy just like loves to pathologize shit, right? Like they pathologize queerness and transness and still do to this day in a way that's just like, this is what we love to do, and it's so problematic. And so like anything that is other is like gonna be pathologized. Right. And that's something that like we really need to critique. Mm-hmm. And we have to look at like, again, how the systemic impacts the personal in a way that like, sorry, I'm getting passionate.
No, I know, I love it.
like how the systemic impacts our personal, and how like that is often the issue, is like how we have been, you know, impacted and oppressed by these systems, and how like the socialization and the normalization of things that like shouldn't be normal are like actually the root of the problem. Right. I mean, I think that it's yeah, lack of education.
Right.
Brings up stuff for people. Mm-hmm. Don't always look at like, don't always critique a lot, which I think is a problem in like in the education of therapists. Mm-hmm. Of all across the board, like even as a social worker, which I think of the licensed professionals, like licensed mental health professionals, like social work has maybe probably the most critique, but like even that I was like pretty wildly underwhelmed by like the amount of critique, like deep critique of like society and how that impacts an individual if you're doing one-on-one therapy. There was, and I think that's something that needs to change. Mm-hmm. Kind of a sidebar, but I think it's related.
I think that what you're saying education wise is just such a big problem. But I also, I think we can also, like, you know, go back to what you're talking about, like, lack of representation in the media of, you absolutely. Know, polyamorous people. Like, because I know, like, and I was, so I'm an actor. I was on set a year ago. And two, and, you know, it was my first, you know, project ever. So I was like, I, you know, very new into the whole thing. And there were two people on, two of my cast members were polyamorous. And so that was like kind of a really like, just like, you know, kind of in like introduction to it, like very,
yeah.
I was like, what? Cause I really never, again, cause I grew up Catholic. I grew up very in a very sure. traditional family. And I was like, it's just something I never seen, so it was kind of, like, very abrupt, and I was like, oh, but then I also got to, like, sit down and, like, ask them questions, and I got to explain, like, so that was also really educational for me, and I that it was really realization of how little that I knew, you know, and
yeah.
And so that was great, but I also, like, it's just, like, lack of ever seeing that in your life, because I don't think I've ever seen that represented in media, like, ever.
No, there's, like, a show, I forget what, yeah, there's, like, a show that was, like, polyamorous, but it's, like, a very narrow representation. It's, like, these thin, white people who are, like, mostly in triads, which is, like, a male and two females. Not all of them are, like, kind of, like, two couples, and, like, it was just a really narrow representation and very, you know, kind of like reality TV-y in a way. And then like, but even in like, there was a non-monogamy plot in like the new L Word, like Generation Q. And it was like terrible. It was such a travesty. And like, I mean, not that any of us queers like really expect the L Word to be like good at explaining and like dealing with these topics, so they have historically not
right.
I digress a little bit, but like yeah, like it's not handled well. It's not handled in a with diversity in mind. Mm-hmm. We haven't even gotten into like any of that, of just like what is kind of the, even within the non-monogamy, like what is looked at as the norm within that. Like there's so much of just like how all of these like, again, systems, white supremacy and racism, of course, and like econ, like classism, like there's so much that comes into play, right. In even in the non-monogamy world, mm-hmm. and like who has access to it and who has like the platforms to talk about it or be out in the world. There's a lot there to unpack as well that I think is really important. I'll just name that and
so. And then kind of moving on, you were talking about just, like, a cultural understanding, not even just on therapists, but, like, so what is that kind of stigma that surrounds non-monogamous relationships? And, like, what are some things that we can do, you know, as we educate ourselves more to help kind of break that stigma?
Yeah, you know, there's so many, I think, stigma and stereotypes. You touched on one that, like, it's a Mormon thing, and like right. that's very problematic because like we see that like that's not a consensual, like there's like statutory rape, there is rape, like there's so much problem, and like that is not what non-monogamy, that's not what like consensual non-monogamy is, that is very non-consensual, like abusive right. dynamics
right.
I think there's this big idea that and it's both, you know, that I think there's this idea that like jealousy is the big issue in non-monogamy, mm-hmm. which is not true. And I think that a lot of people, like, it's not necessarily actually jealousy comes up. It's more of like our attachment stuff that's mm-hmm. coming up. Like it's more like, oh my gosh, like I'm dealing with my own insecurity right now. And it's not jealousy per se. It's more like I have to like, you know, share or like right. then that's really hard, or like I now like because that person has a you know an advanced degree and I don't, now I'm like totally, you know, feeling really insecure about my intellect, right? Like there's so many things that it can bring up that of just like our own insecurities, which can kind of be pushed aside a little bit in monogamy perhaps, right? I think there's a stigma or a stereotype that like this is a white person thing, and that's really problematic. There are plenty and phenomenal folks out there who are, you know, both like coaches and therapists and content creators who are really trying to like just take that stereotype to the edge. But again, that's like the problem with this kind of like normative and who has access to these pieces of like who has access, I would say, to like the cultural like representation. And we see this repeated again and again, even in like the queer movement and like who has been centered in that movement for decades. And so I think that's a stereotype that like, this is only what white people do. And that is absolutely not true. I think some stigma is that, again, people see it as like too complicated or messy. And again, it's when you add more people and more dynamics into a situation, like it will be more, there will be more things to that come up for people that we have to like, you know, honor and look at and it will, like, sometimes also like there's just not enough time. Like dating five people takes a lot of time because dating and being with people like takes energy and intention and all these things. I think, you know, in terms of like the therapist piece and the stigma, it's just like it's not traditional. And I think sometimes people really like to hold on tradition and hold on to tradition and really like feel some kind of like intense, like a visceral kind of like, whoa, like I can't handle anyone questioning like this, this schema I have in my head. Right. And it's a challenge to that. I mean, I would say like, that's been the biggest thing, like in with my own parents who are not mental health professionals by any means, but like, it was just this huge, like, but it's like, it's, it just doesn't work. Or
right.
My dad, that's my dad voice, but you know, like it, you know, like all these ideas of just like, and I'm like, first of all, why do you care? Like, you're monogamous, it's fine. But like, it just, I was like, oh, there's like some really strong feelings about monogamy here that like, I, you know, you're my dad, so I'm not gonna, yeah, whatever. And I think there's like this really like kind of American Western Protestant value of like, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Right.
Like there's this like idea that like you're being selfish or like you're too greedy if you want to, you know, be non-monogamous. Cause like, is it one person enough? And like, and I'm like, fuck that. Cause like, we should all have cake and eat it. And also chocolate sundaes all the time, but whatever, you know, like I want more joy and pleasure and connection in the world. But I do think that is at play as well of just like, the culture, especially in the United States, but I would say like Western culture of like having more partners, like this love is like between two people. And like, I mean, that's, you know, that's one piece of it, but like, yeah, like we shouldn't expect to like have all that pleasure and have all that like relationship fulfillment, which I'm just like, what? Not a fan, but I think that's at play as well.
Right. I feel like, I think people are just so scared of change, so when anything like threatens to change how anyone thinks or anyone does anything, they're like, whoa, back it up right now.
Yeah, and I wonder about, you know, people who just are like, I don't know, this is speculation, but are just like, wow, I can't even imagine like having my needs and wants like honored in that way, that like it's just like, is it knee-jerk rejection because it feels too like oh my god, well, like can't even get into like what their life would be like if they could have chosen that. And that gets back into maybe some like generational stuff and just like we're in a different place and other things there of like not feeling that they were able because of kind of like the culture, the like, you know, oppressive forces of culture at the time, which are still present today for sure, but have shifted a little bit.
All right, so I'm gonna skip five for right now, we'll come back to it. So kind of putting six and then the kind of sub part of six together, you talked about jealousy a little and how it's not necessarily jealousy but like more your attachment a style or whatever, you know, like, which I really got me thinking. I'm like, that's really interesting because putting that in both monogamous and non-monogamous relationships, you're kind of like, oh, that's it. And I had a lady on a couple weeks ago. She's an attachment style therapist. And so we talked about all those because I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, I didn't know what any of that was. I was like, and then it's like, I feel like anytime I have a guest on, it's like, it can always tie back to like another...
Totally,
I'm like, wow, mental health is such, like, full circle for everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But so, like, what are, I guess, some, like, you talked about how communication is so important. Mm-hmm. How, like, what are some ways to effectively communicate? I think in just relationships in general, too, yeah. like, what are boundaries that you can set to you know, benefit everyone and everything like that?
Yeah. yeah. I think to start off, it takes a lot of self-awareness, right? Like, it takes a lot of, like, knowing what your own needs are mm-hmm. and being able to effectively communicate those, both needs and wants and desires, right? But especially needs of, like, knowing what you will and will not stand for, so that, like, maybe you don't even enter into relationships where you're like, oh, that's not going to work for me because, like, I am this person, right? Like you having a deep sense of self-awareness, which is, like, everyone should go to therapy. And it's, I mean, there's a lot of barriers to therapy and it's very inaccessible to a lot of people, but, like, even, I don't know, instead of being more of a passive consumer of, like, social media, like, be an active consumer, journal about things that resonate with you, right? Like, there's ways to, like, I mean, I am hoping for a world where everyone has access to, like, great mental health care. Of course, we don't live in that world right now. We can advocate for that, but, like, there are ways to, like, you know, self-help books and reading about these things and, like, you know, doing that work around them, because I think, like, to be in good relationship and in right relationship with other people, like, you need to kind of have a sense of who you are. Otherwise, you're going to probably, like, either placate other people or, like, your trauma is just going to bleed out onto other people, right? Like, right. We are all traumatized, right? Like, whether it's big T trauma or little T trauma, right? Like, we all, like, society is traumatizing, our families of origin are often traumatizing, like, we might have, you know, experiences in our you know, primary education that we're like, we all have shifts. Like, we just do. That's what being a human in society is. Mm-hmm. And that varies from degree to degree, but you have to, like, look at that. And like, when you look at that, then, you know, knowing how that relates to other people. And I think the more compassion you can have for yourself, like, then you can, then it creates more compassion and more space for other people. And so you can go into relationships with, like, hey, like, this is a thing about me. And then probably have more empathy for other people. And so, like, we're just, like, trying to, like, manage our triggers a little bit more so that we can, like, connect more and understand each other better. You asked about boundaries, and I think that's something that's really key, because I think a lot of people don't actually know what boundaries are. Right. Boundaries are about you. Boundaries are about you and what you can control and what you can enforce so that you keep yourself safe, right? I think sometimes people think that, like, boundaries, I don't, maybe they don't consciously think this, but it kind of comes out as, like, a way to control another person. And that's mm-hmm. not a boundary, that's controlling. Right. So saying something like, okay, like, let's say you're in a non-monogamous relationship and you both are, like, you know, sexually active with other people. Saying something like, my boundary is that you can't have unbarriered sex with other people, like, that's not a boundary. It's like an effort to control what another person does with their body. Mm-hmm. It's a preference, it's a desire, like, sure, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you prefer that your partner doesn't have you know, unbarriered sex with other people. And of course, like, there's also different reasons why. Like, maybe it's a safer sex versus, and, like, risk tolerance thing, right? Maybe it's a more, like, we have this idea that, like, barriered sex is, like, you know, or, like, unbarriered sex, right? Like, it's more bonding, which is a social construct. Mm-hmm. Many people believe it, and that's fine. But the actual boundary would be, like, I will use barriers. It could be like, I will use barriers with people who are having unbarriered sex with other people, right? If it's mm-hmm. about risk tolerance specifically, that's a way to keep myself safe, right? Mm-hmm. You can go do whatever you want, but, like, you and I will have barriers if you are having unbarriered sex with someone else. Or it's stating a need, right? Like, I need lots of reassurance after you've had unbarriered sex with someone else. Like, can you cuddle me? Can we have, you know, sex? Can we have unbarriered sex afterwards? Like, mate, like, consensually, of course, you can't force someone to have sex, but, like, or a fun date, right? Like, what is the need behind it? And then again, the boundary is like, how can I protect myself? And sometimes that a boundary that you thought was a boundary will change into just a need or preference or stating something that you know, want from a partner. And sometimes it will be like, oh, like, actually, to keep myself sexually safe, or in terms of, like, how I define safer sex, is like, I'm not going to have unbarriered sex with people who have unbarriered sex with other people,
right?
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I really like that you specified that it's, like, it's about yourself and your own protection mm-hmm. instead of, you know, other people.
Yeah, I love that.
But like, I'm, you know, I'm someone who struggles with boundaries so much too. So like, but I feel like everyone does. It's hard.
Me too.
That's a big like.
It's really hard.
Conflict.
Absolutely.
And I hate. Like, I mean, like, I hate conflict. So I'm like, I don't want
to. I do too. And like, I again, like, it's really hard. Like, it is hard with like just my personality or who I am or how who I like. These things, like, it has been, I would say, like, my biggest challenge is expressing my needs, because I'm, like, always, like, well, what are your needs, and, like, caretaking, and doing all of this, and then I get resentful, and that's shitty, because resentment sucks for everybody, but honestly, resentment is often just an unmet need, right? It's, like, you didn't express them, like, resentment is usually, like, our own shit that we haven't expressed, you know, and so, like, when I get resentful, and this is, like, I'm 35, I would say in the past two years, that is, like, that's only been, like, oh, you know, so, like, my whole life, I've just been, like, resentful about certain things, and it's, like, Molly, that's your shit, come on, you have, like, time to, like, grow into that, and, like, be able to express their needs, and so that's a lot of the work I'm doing in my own therapy is, like, you know, talking to my little people pleaser part.
Well, and I feel like that's always, like, when you look at, like, issues that you're having, especially with other people, like, half the time you just, like, reflect, and you're like, oh, no, that's because of me, got it, cool,
totally.
That's because of my trauma or my shit or whatever.
Yeah, that's me.
I'm a people pleaser too, so I get it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, a lot of people who are socialized female are, and that's like kind of by design, right? You know, like that's not something that just exists. Like, that's like, I would say, kind of created to control us, or to control like AFAB folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I just think, like, again, of course, honesty, right? And these things are not things that are just in, like, these are great things for any relationship, or like, you want to be in honest relationships, you want to be able to express yourself fully and express yourself and have that be met with someone who, like, can handle their own feelings, and like, when you bring something up, they might, like, you know, they, of course, like, they will have a reaction or a response, right? Like, we don't exist in a vacuum. When someone says something to you, it might bring stuff up, but like, being able to, in a moment, like, if a partner or a loved one or a friend is coming to you with something that's theirs, like, being able to hold space for them and like, and really like honor that, and then like, maybe, you know, a time later, right, whether that's an hour or a day or whatever, be like, or even in the moment, right, if it feels like now that they've expressed themselves and you've honored that, being like, hey, like, I just want to name that like brought up a lot of stuff for me, and I'm feeling really disappointed, or I'm feeling really, you know, hurt by this, and being able to just, like, you know, it's easier said than done to be like, I'm just talking about my feelings in a really calm way, right? Like, you can't always do that, but being able to know that, like, people's emotions are their own to manage. Generally, we can help each other co-regulate, which I think is really important to, like, it's not just like, you have a feeling, go deal with it, which I would say has been a big problem in the non-monogamy community of, like, everyone's just responsible for their own feelings. And I'm like, no, we need more, like, tenderness, and we need to, like, co-regulation is a really big part of how we relate to each other, right? Yes, they're self-soothing, but we have to balance that with co-regulation and how we, like, support each other through our hardships, because that's connecting. And I think that's really important, and something that I'm striving to do in my practice is to, like, lean more into the, like, I call it, like, interdependent autonomy.
Yeah. So we need to be there for each other. Like, it's a...
Exactly. And for ourselves. Yeah. But, yeah, for each other, for sure.
I love that. So, like, what I think, you know, the communication, we talk about conflict, like, what... And you're learning and growing with this as well, but what would be, like, your best advice for people who, like, struggle with that conflict aversion, or, you know, like, just that anxiety, that, you know, people pleasers, like, what would be kind of your best piece of advice for people like that to help them learn to communicate better?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first one is, like, acknowledging that it's there and being really gentle and compassionate with yourself about it. Like, realizing that was, like, something that you were socialized into, and it's not your fault. And, like, acknowledging, like, yeah, it's really hard and it sucks. Like, I think in general, the more compassionate and curious we can be with ourselves around things that we deem as, like, bad, they're not bad. And they've probably, like, honestly, when I look at my own people pleasing, I'm like, you know what? my people pleasing has helped me make really awesome relationships. Like, I am a fucking likable dude, and I love that about myself. Mm-hmm. So acknowledging it, kind of looking at it and trying to neutralize it a little bit. And then I think just honestly practice, practice with little things, right? Like, in terms of just like, if your partner or a friend is like, where do you want to go to dinner tonight? And you're like, oh, I don't care. Like, making a statement, right? Being like, mm-hmm. I want to go get Mexican food tonight. Like, I want to go to Taco Bell, or like, I want to go to, you know, like just little things to start just like saying, like having preferences, right? So starting mm-hmm. little will just, it's muscle memory, right? Like all of the things, like, we're just creating new neural pathways, right? We are always just like, it has to start somewhere. Start with those little things of just like having preferences. And then, I think always like in conflict, taking pauses, going and like taking a time out when you're in conflict and going to like process your thoughts. I know, like, for me, I go into freeze response really quick. So I'll like, my brain will shut down and I will like not be able to respond, which is very infuriating to my partner, right. You know, and I'll be like, I need a break. I'm flooded. And I will go, sometimes I'll do what I call like rage journaling, which is just like, ah, getting it all out, which is just like, no one will read that. And it's like not pretty thoughts. And it's like mean and nasty, but like, it's just kind of, and then when I do that, I'm able to tap into a little more compassion and also like, look at like, oh, maybe these are some of my needs that aren't being met, how can I express them? I think like for something that can help is like just writing your thoughts down and then like literally coming into conversations with like a script, you know, like, right. Like, you know, being like, this is what I want to communicate. So having a lot of intention about communicating, and just like, you know, telling yourself regularly that like your needs and wants are just as important as anyone else's. And the more you can be secure in your needs and wants, I think the more, like, when there's security, insecurity around them, it becomes harder to lean into like flexibility and collaboration, which is a big part of non-monogamy and relationships. Of like, two different people will inherently have two different sets of needs and wants. And like, the more you can both be like, hey, this is what I need, but and be really secure in that, like, the more you can have that flexibility, be like, okay, like, here's a piece that like is really big for me, but like in this way it can morph a little bit, and then you can really find some beautiful ways to like co-create agreements and co-create the relationships of your dreams.
That was such beautiful advice. I'm going to be working on the starting little with like having preferences, because I'm definitely the like, where do you want to go to eat? Oh, I don't mind, wherever you want.
Me too. And I often like don't actually care, but I'm like, it's a good practice to be like, you know what, Chinese food sounds great tonight, you know,
yeah.
Or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. What movie do you want? Oh, I want to watch this. You know, like, yeah, little right. things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. I'm gonna start doing that.
Great. I love it. Me too. No, just kidding. I try. It's hard. It is.
It really is. I think especially if you, like, not to go on a tangent, but, like, if you, you know, grow up with, like, a narcissistic parent, or if you grow up with, like, you know,
absolutely.
Any sort of that, and especially, I not to tap back into religious trauma, but that's always where my mind goes, is, like,
yeah,
it's real. It's stuff that, like, shuts you into little boxes, I think.
Absolutely.
That just
absolutely.
Then stems a thousand different problems.
it's really true. It's really true. And again, I think it comes down to, like, power and control and feeling, mm-hmm. you know, like, how are we controlled in these different ways, and how can we like bust out of that, which is a lifelong process.
Okay, so we're gonna jump back to number 5. Yes.
Okay.
So kind of going to the broader of, you also work with queer and trans people. Mm-hmm. I wanted to, because we are a mental health podcast, I wanted to know if you could kind of give us a overview of mental health in those specific demographics. So like the stats for anxiety and depression and suicide, and how those differ from, you know, maybe a straight white cis man, you know, like kind of the difference between, and how those are different because, you know, they're in that demographic.
Yeah. I will admit that like, I'm not one to have a good memory for numbers and statistics, and but I do know that the disparities absolutely exist. I just can't be like, I mean, actually one statistic I do remember, and this might be old and it might be even more at this point, but like, I remember learning that like 40% of homeless youth identify as LGBTQIA, and 40% of youth are not LGBTQ. And so I think that just goes to show that, like, how many people are disowned by their parents when they come out, right. You know? And so then they're like, they're out on the streets. And so, of course, there's so many traumas related with being unhoused. And there's just so much vulnerability there. And especially when you're a youth and there's not enough services. So that's one statistic that I think, like, is just a statistic that it lives in my mind. I think all of this goes back again to kind of the systemic forces of just like othering queerness and transness, right? Like othering these things. And, you know, when we look at it, generally it causes for anxiety and depression, right? Like, yes, of course there's sometimes and often some chemical stuff going on, sure. But more often than not, it's also like trauma responses, like trauma that is being expressed through anxiety and depression, because like, we have trauma that lives in our body that has been unable to be expressed, right? Like there's so many things and we don't have the support and love, whether it's of a caregiver or parent or like, you know, any primary attachment, a figure. And so that, like, that deep kind of core wound and like that trauma is manifesting in anxiety and depression, mm-hmm. or any other, you know, mental health challenges that folks are going through. I think because of like, again, bringing it to the systemic of like, you know, parents aren't taught to like, you know, how to like show up for their loved ones mm-hmm. in many senses, not just in like identity. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, like because you have society or religion, you know, like, mm-hmm. or whatever factors telling you that like, this is wrong. Like that expresses itself in really toxic ways in families, you know? My own experience was like, and I have a relatively calm one with my family. Like I was not disowned. I came out in my 20s. But there was still lots of shame for my mom, right? Like, you know, and she's, you know, I grew up in definitely like we supported LGBTQ rights. I wouldn't say I grew up in a super political family and like that we would talk about that, or it was just kind of like, you know, name. There was never any homophobia that I you know, experienced or heard. I mean, maybe like through humor, and there's probably definitely like, if I really sit, there's probably some covert stuff there. But then like when I came out, I think it was like, oh my God, like kind of this NIMBY, you know, not in my backyard, like queerness is fine, but like, not my daughter, right, you know, right. Things are fine now. That was like, you know, 15 years ago or whatever. But like, you know, it was like, oh, you can't like, can you not kiss your girlfriend when you come home? You know, things like that, just like these comments that like, oh, are so hurtful. And we've moved through that. Everything's, you know, relatively good and copacetic now, but like, yeah, like there's all kinds of just like, those comments really hurt. And when they're coming from someone that's supposed to love you unconditionally, which is like, you know, the expectation of parenting, which we see does not exist a lot. Like it's just that cuts really deep. That cuts really deep. And then of course, like anxiety and depression, I think it's a ripe fertile ground for those. And that's why, like, you know, this, even the idea of pathologizing anxiety and depression, to me, it's like, well, let's look at the cultural narratives that impact that, and how do we deconstruct those to know like, you're normal, you're fine, like, you know, like it's all of this other shit that surrounds it that that I think is way, way more potent and impactful. I have training in narrative therapy, so I often go to like the structural, right. But I'll leave that there.
Right. Yeah, but like I like that you mentioned the comments that hurt, because I feel like a lot of times when those comments are said, they like, we're like, oh, it was just like a little dig here or a little something here.
Yeah.
But like, A, they hurt even if they're small, and B, like the buildup over time.
Absolutely.
It's like, it's a lot more than you think you were. Absolutely. You know, saying.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you get it from your parents, sure, which is deep and hurtful, but then you also get it from your friends sometimes. Right. And like, you know, even things like no homo or bullshit like that. Right. Like, I mean, that didn't exist when I was a kid, but I see it now. I don't really even know what it means, except like,
right. No, that was a big thing when I was in high school, and I was like, can you not just like hug your friends without
Totally.
Being weird about the thing.
Absolutely, right? So there's all of these like little things that kind of subconsciously get into our psyches and our cultural psyche, but also our personal psyche. Mm-hmm. And not to mention just like, I mean, when we look at the political arena in the United States and how like the legislation against trans people is just heinous and so dehumanizing. Like, you see that on the news, you see that in your social media feed, and you're like, what? Like, who I am is like so upsetting to people. Like, that is so hurtful to like see that like people want you to not exist. Like, how much more dehumanizing does that get? It's just so terrible. Like, it's there's just so much, so the world we live in is really, it can be just like really harsh and cold and awful to queer and trans folks.
And I like, that was something that, I mean, that's always been, whenever I see shit like that pop up, I'm like, that's so heartbreaking, because I'm like, I'm not trans, like, I can't understand how that feels, but I'm like, to say that you don't want someone to, like, be alive because of who they are, like, what? I'm getting heated about this, but I'm like, what the fuck? Like, it's not hurting anyone. Like, it's not your business. Stay out of it.
I think, like, to me, that's the whole thing about any of this, whether it's non-monogamy or queerness or transness, is, like, how does this affect you? And I don't understand religion, because I was not raised religious. And, like, you know, people would be like, yeah, but it's their, like, religious tenet. I was like, okay, but still, like, don't be gay. I mean, again, I say that tongue in cheek. But, like, don't, you know, like, you don't have to, like, you're not trans. You're not queer. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you are and you're closeted. But whatever, you know, like, you're not non-monogamous. But, like, I am not harming you. Like, I am not harming you. It's so basic. To me, it seems so basic. I'm like, how? I just don't get it.
I know. My mom and I are constantly just, like, infuriated, like, having conversations. Yeah. Like, it doesn't concern anyone else except that person. Like, and oh, my goodness. And again, like, on my, so I was raised very Catholic, like, on my dad's side. Because my parents split when I was really young. So, like, my mom was like, I don't really care. Like, you be you and, like, go and explore and learn and educate yourself on whatever you want to do. And my dad was like, this is the Bible, and this is what the Bible says, and then you should do what the Bible says to a T. I'm like, that's weird, because the Bible actually never says don't be gay, but, like, you whatever. And, like, oh, my goodness, I could get on a whole separate
because, you know what, that's a whole other topic. Absolutely.
But I think this transitions perfectly also into my next question is, what are ways that, you know, parents or guardians can make the home a safe, accepting place for children to grow up, you know, not questioning if who they are is wrong or any of that? How can they make a safe, positive environment for them?
Yeah. I love this question, because I think I mentioned, like, my previous life in the nonprofit world was, like, doing parent support and education. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I'm not a parent yet. But I think parenting I want us to have more supports for parents so that parents can, like, do parenting better. And I think a lot of it is kind of similar to, like, I think, again, the relationship has to stem with, like, parents have to look at themselves, right? Like, are there any parts of you that, like, might be triggered by a queer kid, or, you know, and, like, go get support around that. Like, we live in a day and age where there's, like, you can always find, like, online communities, like, if you're in a rural place, right, like, you can always find supports for your specific, like, go to Reddit, go to, you know, like, find a PFLAG, right, and now, like, so many things are on Zoom. PFLAG is Partners and Families of Lesbian and Gays, but I think lesbian and gay folks, but it's, like, that's what its name has been for many, many decades. It's now definitely support for just, like, LGBTQ family members specifically, and, like, people who you know, aren't queer necessarily, but, like, support and love queer people and trans people. Like, there are so many ways to get support, free support too, like, free support. I mean, yes, you can go to therapy if you have the resources and you know, available to do that, but, like, just start, like, kind of, like, looking at yourself, you know, because similar to romantic relationships, parenting will bring up all of your shit, right? Like, your kids will trigger you. Mm-hmm. Your kid, like maybe even more so than romantic relationships, because it's like literally like, you know, generational trauma, like cycles of abuse, or cycles of just like unhealthy cycles, like those get recreated. And the more we just let those be and don't have a critical lens, like we have to do that, I think. Mm-hmm. One thing I really, I love this phrase, and I think I learned it in my education in that old job, was like, praise for being, not for doing, right? So praising your children regularly just because they exist, and not because they did a chore, and not because they got an A on an assignment, and not because they made a pretty picture, right? Just being like, I love you because you're you. And that mentality, I think, like, just being able to like, love and adore and praise any being, right? A partner or a child, just because they exist, is like so beautiful, right? Like that's so, and when you think about it, you're like, oh yeah, duh, that makes so much sense. But like, often it's like, oh, I love you. Thank you. You know, like, thank you for cleaning the kitchen. I love you. Right? Or like, right. Like more in our like, you know, adult relationships, but like, yeah, praise for just like you exist, and like who you are is like meaningful to me just because, you know, you're you. Just understanding kids are whole ass people, right? Like they have their own wants, they have their own needs. They are not an extension of you, even though it probably feels very much like they are an extension of you, but like they're their whole own person, and like honoring who that person is. And again, when you feel like who they are and what they're doing is triggering to you, then like getting your own support on that, but trying as much as possible to not put your own stuff on your kid. Yeah, I mean, validating their feelings, like validating what they're going through, right? Like listening to them, and, you know, never saying things like, because I'm the parent, or, you know, like really. And I very also much want to just name and believe that like children need boundaries. Like I'm not saying, right. I don't believe in just like this, like, yeah, like everyone do what they want. Like, no, like kids thrive and strive with routine and boundaries, right? Like it's. But you can do that in a loving way, and even like create bound, like sometimes it's for their safety, right? Like you have to hold my hand when crossing the street because it's safer and I don't want you getting hit by a car, but like explaining that, right? Like it takes a lot of work. Like parenting also just baseline parenting, like takes a lot of work, but like doing it with more intention and talking and explaining things to kids, like it does take an extra level of work. And we live in this capitalist hellscape that makes that energy, like that emotional labor, really hard to do. But it is really like to, you know, raise healthy and relatively well-adjusted kids. I mean, we're all going to mess up our kids, and that's fine too, in some way, like, you know, you, and then there isn't a perfect parent, right? Like being a good enough parent is like literally actually good enough. It's good. It's great. Like you can't be a perfect parent. That doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, like, yeah, you'll be different than your kid. And then it is, yeah, like curiosity instead of judgment as much as possible. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like everything I said here, I would say to like what makes romantic relationships or friend, like what makes any relationship good is like these basic tenets.
Right.
It's not unique to parenting, and it's not unique to our romantic relationships. It's also all of our relationships.
Right. Just everything, our friendships and everything.
Yeah.
I love that mentioned like the explaining like why a boundary is set, because like, mm-hmm. So I babysit a couple kids, mm-hmm. and I really realized, and I've talked to my mom about this, how often they are like asking why around like, yeah, little things, not even if it's like a boundary I set, or just like across anything, any sort of subject, there's always that, well, why, and there's like such a natural curiosity. Like, so obviously, yeah, when you set a boundary, like, they're going to want to know why they can't do something, you know?
Yeah. Actually, and that brings something else up, is, like, I think, like, doing as best you can to, like, not have to be an authority. Because I know, like, mm-hmm. sometimes it can bring up a lot of insecurity if, like, a kid or even an older kid or a teenager, right, like, asks, well, why? And you're like, you don't know. And you're like, oh, I have to have an answer, because like, I have to be the adult, and like, I have to know things, and like, right. This should be something I know, right? Just being able to like be vulnerable and say, you know, I don't know. Let's go find out together, right? Like something where like, it's okay to not know. Right. I think that's another, just that that's what came up for me when you said that.
No, that's great. Well, and I feel like, you know, we always see adults in general as like this, they're up on a pedestal and they're, you know, they're all wise and they know everything and they have it all together. And I mean, that's what I thought as a kid too. And then I became an adult and I was like, oh my God, no one has this shit together. No one knows. No idea.
No clue. We're all just like, blah, muddling along, like figuring out day by day for sure.
Yeah. No, but like it's okay. I like that you, it was like, it's okay to not know. Cause like, even now I'm like, I'm just the babysitter, but sometimes when they ask me something, I'm like, oh no, I don't know. I was like, I'm going to look stupid now. Like,
totally. Totally. Yeah. I think like being able to be like, I can look stupid. I can be silly. Right. Like just like, yeah, more of that of like,
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that comes with like being secure in ourselves. Like, like the more you can be, the more like security to me is like an embodied feeling of like it's a calm feeling. It's a feeling of like, yeah, like I can, like, again, it's kind of like your own, like, praise yourself for being right. Like no matter what I do, no matter what mistakes I make, because everyone will make mistakes. Like, I still deserve to be happy. I still deserve to exist. Right. Like I am learning and growing just like every other person on this planet. And like, yeah, like really being able to do that for yourself as well.
Yeah. Life is hard enough. We should absolutely praise ourselves for just getting up in the morning, because that's hard.
Literally.
That shit's hard to like get ready and like remember to feed yourself and just live. Oh my goodness. So, especially, so hard. But I love that. And you kind of answered my little like part two to question was like, in any relationships, how can we do that?
Because
it's all our relationships. Yeah. That's just like, I feel like it's just really like being an empathetic person in any area of our life. Just being kind.
Yeah.
Alrighty, so I think we're coming down to the last question.
Yeah.
So we've discussed a lot today. I have learned so much. I'm so thankful for that. Thank you so much.
Yay.
I'm so happy. Out of everything that we've discussed today, if everyone was to just take one thing away from the conversation, what would be that one thing that you would want everyone to really take away?
This is totally, this is like a really, I think the hardest question that I was thinking about these to answer, because I'm like, what's the one tech takeaway? I mean, I know that like in the world, I just want to see more tenderness, right? Like, I just want us to be tender with each other. We're all just like figuring it out. And I want us to like all, like be tender with ourselves, be tender with our loved ones, be tender towards strangers, right? Like, I just want that to be like an ethic that people, I just want that to be like a cultural value. Like, we live in this really individualistic, toxic kind of culture that's like really callous sometimes. And that's just like, hurts my little tender heart, you know? And I can also be I can also do those things. And it's parts of myself that I'm like, oh, I don't love that. And I think like knowing that does take a lot of work, like that's something that like does take a lot of personal work, relational work. Like, we grow in relationships. It's really hard to be tender and kind when we're activated, when we're triggered, when we're flooded, right? Like that is a state of being internal, right? Like you can't help but kind of be quote unquote selfish in that moment. And it's not you like being a selfish person, but like trauma makes it, you know, it brings us back to those places where we were so hurt that like, you know, so the more work we do and to understand ourselves and our triggers, like the more we can be, you know, love those parts of ourselves and be compassionate towards ourselves and then extend that out to others. And like, yeah, I think that comes down to like also like resourcing ourselves, whether that's like just like your general bio needs, right? But also like therapy, coaching, or, you know, any other kind of way that you can just kind of do your work. I'm still like, is that the one takeaway I want to, there's so many, but I'll leave it with that. But I just want us to all be more tender and to, you know, be tender with ourselves and compassionate and empathetic and curious, and also in our relationships.
And what a wonderful way to end. Oh my goodness. I love that. Well, thank you so much. Seriously, so much for coming on today. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
I learned so much. So thank you for answering all my questions.
Thank you for asking.
Of course. I've always been such a curious person, but I'm like, I wanted this podcast
That's great.
To like, my whole thing behind this was like, I want everyone to feel like they're not alone. Like there's somebody out there that relates to what they're feeling. And so like,
absolutely.
I did it by myself for a while, but then I was like, there's so much that I have no, you know, foot in the door with. So like, I want to find people who have such different experiences than me. Because there's going to be people listening that have such different experiences. And I just...
Absolutely.
Like, I wanted to learn to, you know, be a better human too, to educate myself.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you creating this and providing the space for folks and different voices. And yeah, it's been a great experience.
Of course. Yeah. Well, thank you for letting me be your first podcast. I will be linking your Instagram in the description of the episode, so anyone that wants to reach out can.
Awesome.
Yeah, but thank you so much. I seriously, seriously appreciate it, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.
You as well, Emily, and we'll be in touch.
Yes, absolutely.
Bye.
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 Alrighty, you guys, so that was Molly Ray on non-monogamous relationships and mental health surrounding non-monogamous people, as well as queer and trans people and queer and trans youth specifically. Thank you so, so much, Molly, for coming on. I so appreciate you taking the time and we had a very long conversation, and I absolutely adored it. So I hope you guys did as well. Like I said earlier, I will be linking their Instagram in the description of today's episode. So you guys can, you know, get on there, message them, and just chat with Molly about all the things, because they're just a light to chat with. So, I will be linking that Instagram for you guys. And yeah, I hope you learned something today. I hope if you related to anything that we were talking about, I hope you felt like you had someone to relate to, and that you weren't alone if you've been feeling alone in any of the ways that, you know, we might have been talking about or anything. So I hope everyone felt very loved and supported, and, you know, if you didn't have anything to relate to in today's episode, I just hope you felt the joy that was radiating off of Molly, and I hope you learned like I did, because I, like I said, I learned so much. Like, it's crazy. I went after we recorded this episode, my mom was cooking in the kitchen, and I went to my mom and I like shared everything. I was like, bro, you wouldn't believe what I just learned. So I hope that you learned something, you appreciated what you learned today. I know I did. Molly, thank you so, 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 so much again. You are an absolute light, and I hope to chat to you again in the future, and stay in touch. But I think that is going to be it for today's episode. If you haven't heard it yet today, I love you so, 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 so much. You're amazing. You are doing amazing. If all that you did today was just survive, that is absolutely incredible. That's, you know, I've been having some of those days lately myself, so you're not alone. You got this. You're doing amazing. I'm so, 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 so proud of you. I love you all so much, and I'll talk to you in the next episode.